Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors, welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is the first time you join us, I'm Travis Cody, bestselling author, 16 books. I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, and entrepreneurs write and publish their own books. And in that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. A lot of businesses hit revenue plateaus, usually around $1 million a year, and they struggle to break through that. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights. More importantly, how you can do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways that you can implement in your life and business starting today. My guest today, Brandon Kepner, is a highly accomplished behavioral healthcare leader with over 25 years of experience driving transformative change in mental health services. He specializes in adolescent care, eating disorders, and inpatient psychiatric care, and he's consistently demonstrated an exceptional ability to unite teams around a common vision, create true stakeholders in every organization that he leads. This unique leadership approach not only elevates the quality of care, but it also boosts employee engagement, satisfaction, and revenue growth. Throughout his career, Brandon has delivered remarkable results, including an expanding at a behavioral hospital from 72 to 140 beds, while consistently exceeding EBITDA budgets by $200,000 monthly. He's led organizational turnarounds. He's transformed significant financial losses into impressive gains in under 4 months. He's driven exponential growth and expansion across multiple facilities. His strategic leadership extends to M&A activities, operational efficiency, and cultural integration, contributing to nearly $4 million in total EBITDA in a single year. And beyond that impressive personal achievements, Brandon's also a dedicated father of five. His career is a testament to his unwavering commitment to improving mental health services and empowering teams to reach new heights. So today, we're honored to learn from his journey, his vision, and his extraordinary leadership. Brandon, thank you so much for being here. I'm happy you took the time out of your day.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about behavioral health. And behavioral health care. Like, explain that a little bit for people like me that may not be aware of what that means.
Sure. And I mean, if you go back a little bit, it's typically been called, you know, psychology or psychiatric care, but those terms tend to scare people. And so it's kind of morphed into a behavioral, which isn't a perfect definition because behavioral is your behaviors you're choosing to use. Mental health is a little bit more because it's usually about, you know, receptors and receivers and the chemicals in your brain and that mental health aspect. So it's a little bit of a blend of all of those, but it's really the mental health side of the world and how we face those things.
So did you know from a young age that that's like where you were going? And was there like specific experiences in your life that kind of pushed you in that direction?
You know, there really wasn't. I was a very sheltered youth growing up. I had great parents, wonderful life. It was pretty smooth and wasn't really even aware to the extent of these things. I majored in art my first year in college. And I had a talent there, but realized it didn't have the paycheck with it.
Alas, the end journey for most artists. Exactly. I love this. I'm good at it. I don't know if I'm going to eat.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I went forward, I took a job that helped with schooling and schedule, and it was in a group home.
Wow.
And so that was the first one. When I stepped into that role, it really kind of shook my world at first. And I had to kind of wake up to how sheltered I had been and those that didn't have that opportunity.
Oh, wow. So working there, was it just seeing some of the impact that the reason why these kids were at the home that made you realize that there was a need for the behavioral health side of it and the psychology of it?
Yeah. And granted, things evolved. I've been in the field for a while. This was in the 80s. And it was a group home specifically set for court-ordered sex offender male adolescents.
Wow.
So that was my first start. And I worked night shift. And so I was in a room where they had bunk beds with the boys in those beds. And I was at a desk in the middle, making sure that they slept and they didn't do anything else. And I was told, you know, like while you're there and everybody's sleeping around you, read their charts, read their histories, read what they're going through so you're familiar with their cases. And that was the part that really woke me up.
Wow, that's interesting. They would have you do that. But was there anything so I could see coming from a, you know, what you consider like a pretty straightforward childhood upbringing with great parents to be exposed to that. That's got to be kind of a shock to the system, I would think.
It was.
So when you changed your majors, then was the original intention to like go into and possibly work in like a group home scenario and help kids like that? Was that the initial intention?
Yeah, that was part of it. I started shifting, took sociology, psychology, and criminal justice, and let the classes kind of dictate to me which ones I connected with better. And that ended up with the psychology. And then I was pursuing, after I got my bachelor's, looking at a PhD in psychology and in clinical so that I could do not only the therapy, but testing and diagnosing and that kind of avenue. But one college caught my attention, and I kind of shifted gears the more I studied it. And that was for industrial and organizational psychology.
Okay, let's talk about that, because just that word alone is really interesting to me.
You know, the industrial, I don't know exactly where that part comes from, because it wasn't like you think of a factory type of structure.
Sure.
It was really HR and practices and safety and covering yourself and that kind of stuff was that aspect. The organizational side is what I fell in love with. And it was more about consulting firms and how to build teams and motivation and morale and the organization and the way people work with each other. That's what pulled me in.
Wow, I love that. So what's been some of the sizes of some of the teams that you've been in charge then? Like, you know, like what's the smallest team you've worked with? What's been the company that's had sort of the biggest teams that you worked with?
I would say some of the group homes when I started with those, both with adolescents and with eating disorders, we would run like maybe 40 people. And that includes, you know, 24-hour coverage with staff, the doctors, the nurses, that kind of avenue. And those were the smaller ones. And then when I got into the hospital side, you know, we can see upward of 500, you know, at some locations.
All right. So this is really interesting because a lot of the people that I work with that kind of get stuck in that $1 million range, right? A lot, usually, you know, sometimes it's 5 to 10 employees. And then, you know, trying to break past 10 employees seems really impossible to them. So like, let's just talk a little bit about the leadership challenges involved, say, you know, going from working from with 40 employees versus 100, or, you know, 100 versus 250 or 250 versus 500. I'm assuming that there are different challenges at each one of those levels. So can we talk to that a little bit?
Sure. When I was with the smaller groups, it was really about my relationship with each individual person and really knowing their strengths and weaknesses, and then countering with myself and others to help protect against their weaknesses and find a magnifying glass, so to speak, for their strengths and continue to expand and grow those aspects. So it was a lot of one-on-one and connection. And as it grew and I got into larger organizations, and I couldn't maintain that same kind of structure. And so I had to do that with the managers or the directors that would then oversee 50 to 70 people themselves.
Wow. Okay. So I'm assuming most people are not natural born leaders of 50 to 75 people. So if you're working with the managers, what were some of the skills that you found it necessary to teach them to be able to lead at that level?
The person that I worked with in those early stages that had this saying that stuck with me, and I've used it over and over, but whether you're working with the patients that we treated in these hospitals or when you're working with people that you supervise, the saying was still fitting. And he basically said, if you are all rules and no relationship, it'll lead to rebellion. And if you are all relationship with no rules, it leads to chaos. But when you balance your rules and a relationship, it leads to respect. And so I've always tried to kind of share that with them. It's like, you have to be clear with your communication, your boundaries, expectations. You can't expect them to execute on something if they don't know the same vision and the same way to execute. And so the communication is key. And then holding the piece of, okay, if you didn't reach it, why? What was holding you back? What stopped it from happening? How can I help you get there? Because if it's an accusatory, oh, I'm going to hold you accountable, it's their accountability. And if I'm the one saying, I'm going to hold you accountable, it just means I'm going to micromanage you and make sure you do it right. And that is the antithesis to people being able to really grow with you. They need the freedom to make decisions and to be able to be empowered like they own it with their own intelligence and their own strengths, but also knowing that they've got somebody they can lean on.
So how do you break a manager who's got the bad habit of micromanaging? How do you break that habit?
It's scary sometimes, but it also depends on what they're managing. I've seen a director of nursing that in those departments, there's so much going on and there's so much liability if you're not on your team. I'll usually, if I find somebody that's a little bit of a micromanager, I'll try to put them in a position, if they have the right licensure, to run an organization like that, because there are spots when I need a little bit more of that. And then there's other spots where I'll say, sometimes with like a therapist, you have other therapists who have reached their master's degree, have X amount of years of licensure behind that. They need to be able to implement their style into what they're doing. And so if I've got a micromanager doing that side, I'll be frank, I try to give them enough that they can't keep up if they continue to micromanage. Enough tasks that they got to learn to disperse it.
You're like, all right, I'm going to break them. I'm going to give them way too much work and see if they can let it go.
And sometimes it's just like, here, you know this person, trust them. Use the people that you're working with. You've got to be able to delegate and then let them go and do it and return back to you and report how they do. And then don't go undermine what they just did. Let them have their style. Let them do it their way. And if they miss it, it's kind of like, no, I never served in the Army or the Navy or anything like that. But I heard someone once say, it's like, if you give a brand new sailor the gun on the deck of the boat, your job is to make sure that they learn how to shoot it. And you've got to give them that freedom. But if they aim too low and they shoot out the side of the boat, your job is to make sure they only shoot out the side of the boat above the water so that it can be repaired. If you let them shoot out below the water, you just sunk the whole ship.
Wow. That's an interesting analogy. So what's interesting about where you're at now with the company you're working with is you're sort of like a troubleshooter, right? You'll come in and they kind of deploy you to hospitals or buildings where either the CEO is struggling, or maybe you had a CEO that moved to another company and you're replacing them. So let's talk about the challenges of kind of stepping into that.
You know, it's gaining the trust of the people that are there, because as soon as I walk in, their eyes are watching, their ears are listening, and they're like, okay, is this guy going to be a jerk that I'm going to have to navigate around and hide what I'm doing so he doesn't mess it up? Or is he going to help me?
Wait, that happens? People hide stuff?
Oh, yeah. And so really, I try to be transparent and vulnerable. I love Brene Brown's stuff, if you've read any of her books. It fits in so many scenarios. Because if I don't put on this face that I'm perfect and I know everything, then I can share with them that, like, here's what I do know. Here's what makes sense to me, but tell me where you see it different. And it kind of creates an open dialogue where they're not afraid to be wrong. And granted, I've had bosses tell me in the past, no, you're the CEO, so you can't be wrong. And you have to always be ready. And you can't show any weaknesses. And I disagree completely.
Yeah. Well, if you want to talk about the quickest way to rebellion, just get to that point right there. So where's your sweet spot for you as a leader? Where do you like sort of living in terms of like the team size and the things that you're working with?
You know, I like establishing the relationships with the individuals and trying to figure out on a team where the strength directors or leaders are, and finding ways to empower them more, give them more freedom. And then figuring out if I've got the opposite of that, ways to coach and see if they'll hear it. See if they'll respond to it. And if they resist and they fight, then you have to start doing things that help them see that that's not going to work.
All right. So this is really interesting, because I know a lot of times you're coming in to scenarios where, you know, there may be some distress in the leadership team. So for people that are listening to this, and maybe they're that way in their business, maybe somebody's just been promoted to, to a department head, they've got 40, 50 people underneath them. What's your process when you're coming into some place where you know they're sending you there specifically to fix a broken process or fix a broken culture? Like, where do you even start with something like that?
Honestly, I start pretty quiet and I listen, and I'll try to meet with each leader and have them tell me, what do you see that's working? What do you see that's not? And if you were in my shoes, what would you do? What would you change? What would you protect? And what would you make sure that doesn't get changed? And when I gather enough of that from the group, I can start to see a little bit of a vision, and it kind of shapes the way that I go with the next step of things. And then there's always your key performance indicators. You look at the data, you look at the numbers that are showing you where your success is and where your weaknesses are, and then you see how well that matches up with the verbal reports that you get from the leaders.
So if you go in and you start to implement changes, and there is like a high degree of resistance from people, because, you know, the humans are creatures of habit, they get in the routine that makes them feel safe, makes them feel comfortable. In some scenarios, that's also what's creating the problems. Like, how do you as a leader approach that to sort of lead people out of those habits into to where they need to be without coming across as a jerk or dictatorial?
And I'm sure there's others out there that would say, oh no, he was a jerk. But sometimes it's hard because it's going to be different depending on the individual you're dealing with. My first instinct is be patient, because people are doing what they're doing because of what they've learned. And in the environment, what they're doing worked for them. And it helped, whether they got the shiny spotlight that they wanted or they didn't get the spotlight and they were able to just do their work and be left alone. Their behaviors are helping them accomplish whichever desire they really have. And so if I changed the environment, I got to wait a little bit to see how they change their behaviors with it, because they likely will. And if they don't, and they don't like that change, so they start digging in their heels to try to protect the old environment and not let anything change, that's when I have to kind of be a parent. And, you know, raising kids and especially teenagers into young adults, that's the spot where you get, I can't be the toddler dad where I just control it and this is what I want and this is how it's going to go. You got to be a little bit of that. Okay, tell me what you're seeing. What do you want from me? And what would help you be successful? And then also telling them, okay, I hear that, but that's not going to work. You can't have it that way. We've got to stay in this framework. So if in this framework, how would you adjust? And being able to hear that with them. And when I say that, then I think of, I've had an experience with one leader. The corporate office had hired her there. I came in. She'd been there for like maybe a month. And after they came in for a couple of visits, they're like, we think she might be off. Like, this isn't going to fit. This isn't going to work. And she'd come from a government office background. So the caseload was a little lighter. She wasn't as used to being her hands in and doing the work. It was more of telling people what they did wrong and letting them fix it. But anyway, so I met with her. I talked with her. I tried to establish a relationship. You know, she cried in my office and told me about her background and everything. And I'm like, okay, let me give it a little bit more time. I told the corporate group, give me a couple months of working with her and let's see where it goes. And I should have seen it. I didn't. She started sabotaging things. She was set that I was the wrong leader. And in behavioral hospitals, you have a lot of government regulation and surveyors that come in and make sure you're checking all the boxes. She started calling these regulation offices to make complaints about what we were not doing correctly in the hospital that were her job, that were her responsibilities. And when they showed up to do the survey, they're like, wait, you're the director of this? And I knew right then, because they can't tell us who made the complaint, but they have it there. And they're like, they were just confused as to why someone would call in, make a complaint about something that was missed, that was their responsibility. And so that one backfired on me. It ended up causing a lot of delays and the growth didn't really come because I was too patient and thought maybe my own ego got too big and I thought I can change it. I'll fix her. And it really didn't work that way.
Wow. Well, that's that's a good lesson. So when you were working with a hospital where you took it from 72 beds to 140 beds, I mean, that, you know, you're essentially doubling the size. And that's just the beds. Does that triple the amount of employees you need to facilitate that? Or does that
It really doesn't, because there's the administration and support staff. So let's just use a small example. If I have 5 billers for the processing payments and I double the beds, I don't need 10. Or 15, I can just divvy up the caseloads and I could probably get by with 7 to 8.
Wow.
It's not the exact same multiplication. There are ratios of per patient, direct nurse, or direct care line staff that you have to stay in those ratios. But at the support side of the administration, it doesn't grow the same exponential.
That's so fascinating to me. So when you come in and you're working with leaders at this point, it sounds like you've worked with dozens, if not hundreds of leaders. From what you've observed, what are maybe like the 3 traits that every sort of great leader has had that you've noticed?
I would say number 1, humility. It's not about them. And they're focused on the work that they're doing and the people that they're helping mentor or coach into finding that success. When that's their focus, I can do a whole lot more. When the ego and the pride is there, it stunts any kind of growth that I can get with them. Sorry.
So I was going to say, so how does like the ego and the pride, what are some of the ways that'll show up with the leader?
Resistance to coaching themselves. When they are the smartest one in the room, no matter who's in the room.
Surely this never happens in the healthcare space.
Well, and what's crazy is how often it happens with the doctors. They they are praised for their intelligence and their ability to get through med school. And I would never want to, I mean, I have my own son who is, you know, really into anatomy and all that. And I'm like, be a doctor. Yes, you struggle through med school, but then you're set for life.
Yeah.
And then he started taking chemistry and he's like, no, I'm not doing that. But again, they are incredibly smart people. They do great work, but there's nothing in med school that teaches them how to lead others. Mm-hmm. And so when you get a medical director or you're working in a treatment team, which consists of the nursing, the therapy, the line staff and the doctors and the pharmacy, and they're all looking at each patient individual and saying, this is what they need. This is what we're going to work towards. The doctor leads that treatment team. But you've got to focus with a team and listen to the rest of their input. And sometimes egos struggle to listen.
Isn't it interesting at this day and age where, you know, I've talked to quite a few doctors for this project, and that has come up a lot about how one of the things that schools aren't teaching is the leadership aspect of it. And so the entire industry is aware that this is a problem. Why is this still, like, to me, it feels like there's resistance from the schools of teaching that as a part of it, unless you're going into specifically like, you know, medical management, and I'm sure there is, but it's just interesting to me. Like, it's the same thing with, I talked to one doctor and he was just talking about the fact that they don't teach communication or a patient relationship with the doctor. It's all just the science. And then you're thrown into the thing and now, you know, dealing with somebody who's been in pain for 3 months and they're yelling at you and now you don't know what to do, right? The de-escalation in that case. And so, like, it's just interesting to me that these are known issues in the medical field that schools are still just kind of like, la, 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 la.
Well, and it's interesting because it's the same way in nursing and therapists. They teach the training. And then you do internships and you do all these countless hours to be fully licensed. And then when they're doing that work, you can see those that are doing the patient care and really good at that. And they'll usually get promoted, but they don't have the leadership skills or the management skills. But because they were such a good worker, they get promoted into those positions and then it breaks, and doesn't flow. And then other times it's the exact opposite where, you know, somebody gets a lucky break and there wasn't anybody else with that license. So they get promoted and then they shine because they understand the management side better than they were even as a direct worker. It's really hard to tell until you put them in the water and see how well they paddle.
How they paddle. Well, that's a good one. All right. So humility is one trait. What's a couple of others?
I would say an awareness that they've got to roll up their sleeves and do the work sometimes.
Oh, that's work.
You know, I was at one hospital recently and they had a director of assessment. So when people first come into the hospital, they do an assessment with them, kind of get a gauge for where they're at, what they're dealing with. And if their cases really need to have an inpatient stabilization, or if an outpatient seeing a therapist here and there, what would work best for them? And she would relentlessly jump in there when her staff were like, hey, we just got nine people just showed up at the front door. There's only three of us. How are we going to do this? She would just jump in and be like, okay, let me take it. And she would start seeing a couple and then giving them specific directions instead of just like, somebody says, help me. Like, okay, what is it that you're going to work on and what do you want me to work on? That open communication and then that ability to jump in and be like, okay, I'm going to take these two, you take these two. It's a clear communication in chaos while not just giving directions and then going back to our office and disappearing, but jumping right in there and doing it with them.
You know, when I did my CPR, my CPR training, but my first aid training was, you know, that's what they talk about. If you show up on a scene and everybody's kind of standing around, like the first thing you do is just point at somebody and be like, you call 911, you stop and like just point and give people specific directions, because as soon as you've been given a direction, you're like, oh, let me go do that. But if nobody's telling them what to do, the default mode is like, oh, I don't want to do anything because I'll get in trouble.
Right.
So, all right. Third and final trait, if there is one.
I would say you can't stop learning. And so you've got to be seeking out ways to improve, seeking out what can I do more, and not taking it as a personal attack or a characteristic flaw, but, you know, being open to regular criticism or evaluation of how we can do things instead of getting stuck in that. But this is what we've done before.
Yeah, that's it. That's a good, you find that in every industry, everywhere. I've worked in so many different industries and that, yeah, but no, this is what we've always done before. Well, how is that working? Well, we're in trouble. Maybe we should try something new. It was really interesting. I have a client that I've worked with. He published two books through Penguin and both of them hit the New York Times bestseller. And on the second book, he wanted to do some really innovative marketing. And the publisher, he's like, hey, here's what I'm going to do. I need a concession on the book price because even publishers make the authors pay wholesale. So if a book sells for $20, the author still has to pay $10, even though the print cost is like $2, right? And so he was going to the publisher going like, can I at least just get my books at the print cost? Because I'm going to do this marketing thing and I think I can sell 10,000 copies of the book. And they literally said, oh, you can't do that because that's not what we do. We don't do it that way. And he even said, he's like, but I'm pretty sure I can sell 10,000 copies. And like, we get it. We get you're going to sell 10,000 copies. And that would be more copies than any other author has sold in the last 6 months. But that's not the way we do it. And I was just, so he was sitting. So now he's independently publishing his third book because he was like, he was so flabbergasted that they were like, that can make us money, but not that way. So,
well, and it's interesting because I've seen that a little bit, like with the hospital that we doubled our beds. I was beating the bottom line EBITDA or profit by 200,000 above budget every month. I don't like highlight this part all the time. I was exceeding the budget on the salaries and wages by 100,000 every month as well. So I had a VP over me that was like livid and could not let that stand and wanted to squash that immediately. And I said,
even okay, though you still had this crazy profit,
I'm like, okay, but for every $1 that I'm overspending in that category, I'm giving you two over here. Most people will take that. And he's like, no, you just need to cut. You need to cut. That's why I'm not with that group anymore. But it's even in that though, I mean, that's again, it's that mentality of, hey, I went outside the box and I, not to get too far behind, but there was a different VP that was there that I had a really good relationship. He retired, new one came in, and that's what kind of broke it, so to speak.
Wow. Now that's crazy.
To get there, I asked the staff there and I said, you know, who in this community is respected? You know, we have an open director role. Anybody you know of that could fill this. And I kept getting the same guy over and over again. And apparently he'd been CEO at another hospital in the community. And he had taken a job in Texas, moved out of state. And so I got his information from all these staff that kept referring to him. I reached out to him and I said, look, I know you're a CEO, you're in these other roles. Is there any way I could get you to come in and be a director with me at this hospital? Because all these people are talking about the great work that you did. And he said, you know, my family is still living there and I'm commuting back and forth. I'd love to. He came back and quite frankly, he was the reason that that hospital succeeded and that we were able to open up all those beds because people flocked to work with him. And I get credit sometimes for being the CEO, but the only times I've really found success, it wasn't because I did something magical. It's because I found people who were the magic and I got out of the way.
Well, you know, I think that's probably the key, right? You find the people who are good at their jobs and give them the tools to be able to actually do the job. And as an employee, I think that's probably the most frustrating thing for employees is having the skill and having the talent and then not being able to use it, which is where you'll end up seeing, you know, high turnover. All right. Well, I like to end every conversation with three specific questions. So we'll jump in here. If you could go back and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be and why?
Be patient. And I'm still not patient.
Which is funny because I bet if we talk to a lot of your employees or your managers, they're like, he's like the most patient manager we've ever had.
It's kind of like humility. You think you have it, you don't.
So over the 25 years you've been doing this, what belief or mindset shift has had the biggest impact on the success of what you've been doing?
That every person has a story that will move you if you really give yourself time to get them to share it.
That's a pretty powerful insight. Final question. What's the best investment you've ever made in yourself?
My wife.
All right. That's an easy one. That's a good one right there. So if somebody's listening to this and they're in the healthcare space or the behavioral healthcare space, and they want to connect with you and maybe have a conversation, what's the best way for them to find you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty open there. I try to keep my social media a little more private because otherwise I get patients and others that
like fair enough. LinkedIn, Brandon Kepner on LinkedIn. Brandon, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.